posted. I don't, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so on our preamble information under section 2D that said members of the public, et cetera, need to contact the court, maybe we just need to change that language, Jamie, to say something along the lines of members of the public, including friends or family who wish to attend a virtual hearing, may do so through the court's website and/or by directly contacting the court if necessary.
Okay. Got it.
That way, hopefully, if we direct them to the website up front, then they will avoid having to contact the court. And they'll only need to contact the court if it's a situation where those links aren't available on the website. All right, so let's go then. And I don't want to keep everybody too much longer today. I appreciate your time. In the family side of things, I don't know if we have anybody here other than Patty that was part of the family.
Yes, we had a very slim subcommittee hearing. It was me, Marshall, and I think Almeida. I think that was
Yeah, right.
I think
But I
that
look, family court had agreement on everything other than
was it.
settlement conferences, I think, and that went to what Paige
Yeah.
was the agreement was judge's discretion. So I think if we were going to make the change that we talked about earlier and put some language in there about that, that probably would be good with the family side of things.
Yeah. So yeah, that was the only one we couldn't come to a consensus on. And for all of the reasons that we just discussed on the civil side, it's really hard to presumptively have a mediation slash settlement conference in person versus virtually. It really is case specific. And, generally speaking, I mean, other than the judges who are very, very adamant about everybody has to be there in person, for the most part, most of the settlement judges are very accommodating as to what the parties want to do. If the parties agree and the judge agrees. So we just couldn't come to a consensus on that one. So we just will, I think we'll just do the double NAs with or without the comment, depending on which way we're going with that.
Paige, you're on that subcommittee too, right?
I am, and apologies to Justice Lee and my other members. I missed our last meeting, but and I've attended the others and I think that we did have the agreement that's reflected on our template. But then I based on the discussion about mediation for civil, because at the end of our the second page of our family court rules, there's also a mediation section. And maybe we
Right.
should take that out as well, because I know in my orders setting mediations for dependency and terminations. We defer to the mediators, whether it's going to be in person or virtual anyway. So maybe that's applicable to the family rules as well as civil.
Okay. Yeah, the only other thing that I had in the family court that I wanted to point out is under temporary protective orders, ex parte applications for TPOs, you have it as presumptively virtual. My understanding of Supreme Court Rule 9, number 4, part whatever, it references that ex parte motions that have a hearing are mandatory in person unless it's a particular type of hearing. So I can tell you the exact language. Hold on, let me pull it back up again. So, since we're trying to make sure our rules don't conflict with the current iteration of the Supreme Court rules, I just wanted to make sure that we figure out a way to kind of harmonize this. But let me see here. Let me get this open. All right. Supreme Court Rules, Part 9, B, Rules Governing Appearance by Audio Visual Transmission equipment for civil and family court. It is Rule 4, appearance by simultaneous audiovisual transmission equipment. In addition, a personal appearance is required for the following persons or parties: 2A, applicants seeking an ex parte order if a hearing is held, unless the applicant is seeking an order. That, and then it lists, four exceptions: extension to extension of time, writs, stipulation of the parties, asking to exceed page limits. So under that, my belief is if you have a hearing on an ex parte motion, then it should be in person. But do you all have any kind of hearings on ex parte applications for TPOs, or just hearings to extend them after they've been granted?
I can speak to in the second, the vast majority of the initial temporary protection orders are granted just on the pleadings by our master and judges that do those.
Okay.
However, in some circumstances, when the judge wants more information or wants to hear from the parties, they'll order that a hearing be set. I think that's in the minority of cases. So by our Supreme Court rules would mandate that if a hearing is set by the judge, then that should be, that must be in person.
Yeah. So maybe we create a second category here. We have ex parte applications for TPOs without hearing, you know, parenthesis without hearing, ex parte application for TPOs where a hearing is held. If a hearing is held, it should be presumptively in person. And if there's not a hearing being held, then it could be presumptively virtual.
Do we need a category? Well,
there would be no reason. There would be no reason to have that first.
Exactly.
Segment.
Good point.
Yeah.
Thank you, Patty. We don't really need a ex parte application for TPO no hearing.
Right.
Right.
Because there's no hearing.
Right.
And the, from the justice court's perspective, and I'm pretty sure that most justice courts are the same. We do it exactly as the judge just stated. Most of those are done in a chamber's review unless the judge feels like they need more information on the temporary application, and all extended hearings are in person.
Okay.
So what they're doing in the
eighth. So Jamie, I think maybe we just modify what's there now to say ex parte applications for TPOs with hearing.
Okay.
Actively in person.
Okay.
What they're doing in the eighth is a little bit different. So if I send a client down to get a TPO and they fill out the application, the TPO hearing masters have calendars that day and they can hear them in person, or they can apply online and then it's decided on the pleadings.
Okay. So it sounds like they're abiding by the in-person part of it if they actually have a hearing.
Correct. So if the person is there in person and it's not decided on the pleadings, they're allowed to stay and have a decision that day and walk out with a TPO that day.
Okay. And if the judge, for whatever reason, or the master decides they don't need a hearing, then it's really irrelevant what our presumptions are anyway. Okay.
This is Alicia from the second. I did not participate in the family subgroup, but with respect to domestic violence TPOs, I don't know if there was any input from domestic violence advocates. We are still hearing those extensions primarily virtual. And I will say that our statistics show that we have a higher rate of participation in those virtual hearings. The common thought is that we have applicants who are more willing to come because they don't have to physically sit in court next to the adverse party. And so our advocates in the North have actually asked us to keep those virtual. Just as we're working through this, I wanted to make sure that that feedback was at least somewhere in the dialogue.
Okay. Paige.
And in our committee meetings and our subcommittee meetings, we didn't have that voice from domestic violence advocates.
What if we did that again, NA?
What, Ron?
Well, I think maybe based on, and I'm sorry, I can't see everyone's name, but whoever was just speaking, I think that's a great point that when you have domestic violence applications, I mean, Justice Herndon, does the rule that you just read apply to those domestic violence applications for TPOs?
Probably not, because it's ex parte, speaking to ex parte, and a motion to extend isn't going to be ex parte.
Gotcha.
Because by
yeah,
then, the
I mean, can we?
Party's been served.
Right.
I think
could we carve
a little
out?
Dicey, though. It's getting a little dicey in my mind to say we're going to talk about taking somebody and extending a temporary protective order against them, and you know, people don't have to come to court to kind of justify why that should happen. And I totally get the domestic violence advocate's side of that. It's the same thing. Look, you see it in criminal proceedings where a victim doesn't necessarily want to have to come to court when guy that's alleged to have done really bad things is going to be there as well, whether it's domestic violence or other any other type of abuse. My sense is the judges would want people to be in court to be able to speak to whether they need to extend this thing or not.
Is there a way to provide an exception? So this has happened three times to a client. They were not able to serve the defendant or respondent, and my client had to keep physically going down to court and learning in court that he's not been served and then getting a new date. She should have been able to appear virtually. Is there a way we can carve out an exception so that
victims So are you saying, Audrey, they're going down for an extension hearing and that's the first time they find out that the guy was never served with the original TPO?
Correct.
Oh, wow.
Because sometimes they're set pretty quickly, depending on if, you know, if the perpetrator was arrested and then released and they're, you know, they get their initial and it's set pretty quickly. The last one, it was probably about a month. He'd been released. He'd been evading service. They hadn't been able to serve him. She showed up. She got another extension and another hearing. And then to her knowledge, he had not yet been served. She didn't show up in person. There was no option to appear virtually. And so it was denied. So now she's got to go through the whole process again if he resurfaces.
Okay. So
a little to add to that, Justice Herndon, from the justice court perspective, we give our temporary protective order packages when we're setting them for hearing to the civil sheriff who serves them. However, if the applicant provides insufficient information or the address is no good or something like that, they are not investigators. They will literally just go to the address and attempt to serve where the adverse party is said to be by the applicant. If they're unable to locate them or unable to serve them, what happens in the justice court, we get a notification back or a, you know, basically a due diligence form from the civil sheriff saying they were unable to serve. We prefer for that applicant to be present in court because the next step is the applicant has to hire their own investigator slash process server to find them and have them served. And we give them the packet. I sign a new order to appear at the next hearing, which has to go with the application, and the adverse party needs to be served with that. The only way they're going to get those documents is if they're in court and I hand them to them, or we send them down to our TPO desk to get the service packet to serve. So I'm not sure how that would happen repeatedly. If the civil sheriff can't find them at the location, we're not just going to continue it and say, let's try again at the same place. The onus is on the applicant then to serve.
Alicia, does your, the way you're describing it, are the person against whom the TPO is sought, are they allowed to appear virtually for a motion to extend as well?
Yes.
Okay. So everybody yes. has that option.
All parties can appear virtually. We do have similar service issues in Washoe County. I mean, part of it is that statutorily evictions get served prior to protection orders. So oftentimes we see these protection orders that have been sent to the sheriff for service that really we're at day 20 after a TPO issues before they're even attempting service. So we do have similar service issues where then we end up having to extend it out. With respect to, and I, as full disclosure, we're doing a deep dive right now into all things TPO. We've been discussing it with the sheriff's office. We've been discussing it with our lower jurisdiction courts. With respect to some of these applicants, I mean, Washoe County isn't the biggest county, but it's plenty large enough and we don't have good public transit. A lot of times we're dealing with applicants that have been displaced from their homes. They don't have transportation. They don't have childcare. And so again, all that plays into some of those increased appearance rates that we're actually seeing at the EPO hearings because they can attend virtually rather than physically at the court. But yes, absolutely. The adverse party is also attending virtually. We do have service issues then, because now the EPO, instead of us just handing it over in court, now the EPO does have to be served separately. And we do ask applicants if or adverse parties if we can email the EPO and if we can get service that way. So we're working through it, but I would hate to see the, I would hate to see that ability to hold those hearings virtually go completely out the window.
So Paige, you have anything to add on that? I mean, it does sound like this may be something that would lend itself to presumptively virtual.
I don't have anything to add to what Alicia said. I agree with her comments.
Okay. So look, understanding the ability of a judge in a particular case to say, hey, I want people in here on this case, right? Because of the history or whatever it may be. I think it sounds like being presumptively virtual would be a better idea on that. But I have a, I need to go back to what Audrey was talking about because that's a little surprising to me. Is there a mechanism by which a applicant can contact the court and find out if the guy has been served? I mean, I'm assuming that there isn't an automatic reach out to them to let them know they have been served, but right. I'm a little troubled that they're showing up at hearings never having known that they really didn't have the protection that they thought was in place.
Right. And so in the example I gave, I represent the victim in an abuse neglect case. I don't also represent her in the TPO case, so I don't have access to it. If I had access to it, it would be a non-issue. She has to call the TPO office and ask if they've been served, if she's not been notified.
Okay.
If she doesn't do that, and again, we're talking
about-
Let me
pause you for a moment. I apologize for interrupting. In your experience, are they automatically notified when they have been served?
They are supposed to call them and let them know if they've been served.
Okay. So if she hasn't heard anything, then she's going to call to say, just checking in, what's going on?
Correct. Now, you won't always get a phone call back because there's not always a person answering the phone.
Okay. So there's just going to be situations where they haven't been served and they can't get anybody on the phone and they just don't know. And then they show up at an extension hearing.
Right. Or they give up and don't show up because they haven't gotten a call that it's been served and then it gets denied because they didn't have the option to appear virtually.
Okay. Does it work similar, Alicia, in the second?
Yeah, in the second, they are called and notified when it is served. Again, that requires us having good contact information for them. And then they can also access their case electronically. So once the sheriff's office once the sheriff's office completes service, they electronically file into our case management system that proof of service. We offer electronic filing to all applicants. This is the one case type where we don't require applicants to sign up for an e-filing account, primarily because at the time that they're filing those applications, they're in crisis and it's just, that's one extra step and one extra hurdle for them to overcome. But if they are e-filers, then they'll receive automatic notification the moment that that service is filed into the record.
Okay.
Surprised that the court doesn't just vacate the hearing if no one's been served and then send out a notice of vacating the hearing.
The court has to have a finding of due diligence.
Yeah, you got
to
wait.
There have been attempts at service in order to.
Gotcha.
And sometimes it may be that at 6 o'clock the evening before the guy gets served or something, they finally effectuate service. So I get why they're not vacating them ahead of time. But yeah, let's go ahead and move that to a presumptively virtual.
Okay.
So ex parte application for TPOs with hearing presumptively in person, motion to extend or dissolve presumptively virtual.
Okay, got it.
All right. I didn't have anything else on the family other than the mediation issue, which Paige already addressed. Anybody else have anything on the family?
I do. And I apologize because I was not able to attend the subcommittee meeting.
That's okay.
One of the things that we had talked about in December, and Judge Dollinger, you were going to check into this and get back to me, was that we have minor and adult guardianship hearings presumptively virtual, but the 432B guardianships are presumptively in person. And again, we're talking about these are arising out of abuse neglect cases. These are usually, people that may not have transportation or they're, required to get the kid out of school and bring them to a hearing. I don't know why they're presumptively in person when all of the other guardianship hearings are presumptively virtual.
Yeah, this is Patty. I'm not sure why that was marked that way. The last meeting was my first meeting. So I don't know that there's, well, I guess you've been on the committee, the subcommittee. Maybe you can, I don't know what those deliberation processes look like. But the majority wanted those, for some reason, the 432B ones to be presumptively in person. I don't know the rationale behind that. Alicia D, I'm sorry, not Alicia, Almeida. I think, were there any comments about that that were submitted in writing? Or do you have any discussions with now about that was?
Unfortunately, I can't recall. I didn't have any information submitted in writing. It was just what we discussed during the meetings. Judge Dollinger, do you remember anything?
Kristen, no, I don't, although definitely Ms. Beeson's raises a good point. When we have all of our minor guardianships presumptively virtual, I don't know about the 8th or in other jurisdictions, but in the 2nd, within the realm of dependency, we're not really hearing guardianships out of 432B cases. They're all sort of going into the minor guardianship category. So a different judge hears those. We historically, you know, the dependency judge and dependency cases in the 2nd can and used to hear guardianship petitions out of those cases. We just do it differently now. But if I was going to preside in one out of a 432B case, for all the reasons that all my other hearings in that regard are presumptive virtual, I would want it to be presumptive virtual for all those same reasons. The indigency of the parties, the convenience, well, I should say the indigency of the parents, the convenience of the parties, whether it be a older relative caregiver that's getting guardianship of the kids or somebody else. And I'm very confident that that's what the stakeholders in the 2nd would want as well.
I think that makes a lot of sense. This is Patty. I don't know why that was kind of excised out and given a different presumption, but I'm okay with, for all the reasons, and no one said anything to the contrary, that we should make that just consistent with the rest of the guardianship hearings and make that virtual, presumptively virtual.
Is there anything, Audrey, that you're aware of? Because look, I be perfectly honest, this isn't my area of expertise, obviously. Is there anything about 432B abuse neglect cases versus other guardianship issues that would make this more ripe for in-person? Or no. Is it just a separate designation that, you know, we can proceed under, you know, 432B, we can proceed under these other issues, and we're dealing with the same kind of big issue at the end of the day?
Right. The major difference is if it's a guardianship with KINGAP, so there's a financial component, but right. These guardianships that are heard in the dependency court are given to contract attorneys that just do these. And there's no, again, there's no difference. It's besides a couple of different questions that you ask the petitioners, which is a little bit different from a 159 when you canvass the petitioners, there's no difference. So I don't know why that they need to be in person. I know that there is a dependency judge that would rather have everything in person. But again, that same dependency judge makes parents come down with kids to close out a case. And we're talking about, 2 or 3 hours on a bus and pulling kids out of school just so they can spend 30 seconds in a courtroom for the judge to say, your case is closed out.
And, just really quickly, of course, if it's a contested guardianship hearing, that would fall under the category of evidentiary hearing or trial, which would be presumptively in person if they're being contested. And 432B cases, they're usually not contested because it's to the parents' benefit. So they're not having to go through a termination of parental rights, and they're getting, you know, a guardianship. So,
well, right. And based upon what you guys are telling me, the wisdom of virtual and every other type of guardianship proceeding would seem to apply to 432B as well, with the understanding, as always, that a judge can say in a particular case, I need people in court. Because there's something different or special about this one that I want to get people in the courtroom on. So, okay, then let's.
Hey, I'm sorry, this is Patty again. On the issue that was raised about case closures and forcing people to come down there, is that another category that we can add to our presumption list and just say that case closures are presumptively virtual?
That would be wonderful.
Let's do it.
And this is Jonathan Norman. I'm with the legal service providers. I used to be a CAP attorney, so representing kids in dependency, abuse, and neglect. And I agree with both the last two moves to virtual for the case closure. I know that's created a lot of problems that Ms. Beeson highlighted, and then also on the 432B guardianships. And I don't see any issues.
What are case closure hearings? Are they status checks? Are they a specific case closure hearing?
So sometimes it depends. Sometimes it's on for a 6-month or a 1-year review hearing, and the department is recommending case closure. Okay. And in that instance, you know, we get the, let me kind of give you a little bit more information. We get those reports on a Thursday or a Friday, and the hearings potentially Monday.
Okay.
We have to then scramble, if we've had time to read the 84-page report and the attachments, to look and see what the department is recommending. Hopefully we're not in trial. And then we have to let our client know that because the department is recommending case closure, our particular judge requires an in-person appearance of the parent and the child. That parent then has to miss work, find transportation on a very short notice, take the kid out of school, et cetera. Sometimes a stipulation and order is circulated when case closure is appropriate, and we all know that it's going to close out. And the same thing happens then. And not that it's bad, but sometimes we'll submit a stip and order and it's the next day or it's 2 days. And again, if I'm not opening every single stipulation order to see when that hearing is set, I don't have time or the ability to let my client know, hey, it's been set for tomorrow. You need to be there in person. It's just such a burden for, again, what is 30 seconds to say, this is really important. We don't want to see you back here. Case closed.
Okay.
I totally agree with Ms. Beeson, and it, in essence, it's like punishing the family for being successful.
These generally are favorable to the parent and the child, right? We're closing this out now.
Either that, or it could be like parents signed a consent to adopt and the adoption's finalized. So now we want to close the case. We don't need to have another dependency hearing. But what we do in the second to avoid that exact circumstance is I, in an order, will give the Washoe County Human Services Agency discretion to close the case by letter and submission of a dismissal order in between the 6-month review and the 12-month permanency hearing, or in between hearings. And we utilize that option frequently.
Okay.
And so then nobody has to come to court. The case closes. There are some cases that will close at the time of the hearing, but I will say, and we've done that for years in our jurisdiction. And so it's that, so then you don't even have to have a hearing virtual or in person. The case, there's no reason the case can't close on the pleadings with a letter that's in the record as to all, and you know, the agency has to provide the reasons why they're recommending case closure, and the judge has to review that and sign off on it. Sometimes it's because a guardianship was granted in another judicial department. Sometimes it's because the adoption is now finalized. Or sometimes it's because the parents have successfully reunified and the children are no longer children in need of protection.
So where would we put case closures on our family court diagram? Will we just put it under all case types? or does it specifically go to juvenile dependency, to adult and minor guardianship?
It's specific to juvenile dependency. You could even put it, you know, with reviews, permanency, case closure, because again, more often than not, it's going to happen at a review hearing.
Okay.
I agree. If you're going to have a hearing in that regard, it should be presumptively virtual.
But under generic minor guardianships, there wouldn't be case closure hearings?